Let's go ahead and get started a little bit early than on our last speaker. This is Professor Arianna Myers, and she is an attorney at Vogel and Town, and also a visiting assistant professor here at the law school.
Thank you, Tammy. Yes, as Tammy said, I am a visiting assistant professor. This is my first year teaching here at UND. In addition to that, I do have a family law practice at Vogel Law Firm. I have done a little bit of criminal work as well and some civil litigation, but today we're mostly going to focus on criminal and family law work in terms of how social media use certainly does come up in those cases more frequently likely than other areas of the law. So social media, right? It's a very popular form of communication all over the world because it's so accessible. We have the ability to engage in conversation via technology, electronic devices from anywhere we are. I mean, those of us in this room, when I look at all of you, I see cell phones, I see laptops. It's very accessible and now very affordable. There is free Wi-Fi in most places. So what does that mean? It means that people are communicating more than they ever were before. It used to be that we'd be at work all day, we had landlines, go home, and you'd again speak to your friends and colleagues from a landline. Now most of our communication is really by text, right? It's in the form of some kind of textual format, whether that's an email, a tweet, a post, or it may be in a video, it may be in a Snapchat. And how is that impacting our cases? Well, as of 2017, that's the most recent stat I could find, 81% of the United States population had a social networking profile, which is quite astounding. I mean, that's a very high statistic. How has our North Dakota Supreme Court looked at social media? And this is one recent case that Justice Jensen, who we all miss here in Grand Forks, wrote the opinion on. And I think it's really interesting the way he analyzed social media, the admissibility of social media posts at the district court level. So I've kind of summarized the facts for you a little bit in terms of what's applicable. The defendant in this case, he appealed his criminal judgment after he was found guilty of attempted murder. Now he argues that the district court, so the trial court, erred in admitting social media posts he had made prior to the alleged crime that he committed. Now, he did not dispute the fact that those were his posts, okay? So there was no authenticity issue with the posts. What he disputed was whether or not they should be able to come in and be considered as evidence. The state, of course, was who offered these posts, and what they offered them for was to prove his state of mind at or around the time he committed the attempted murder. And so he had an attorney at the trial court level who, of course, objected to the admissibility of the posts, arguing that they were not probative and they were extremely prejudicial to his case. The district court overruled the objection and admitted the social media postings with a limiting instruction. And the limiting instruction to the jury was, you can take a look at these posts, but only for the purpose of the defendant's state of mind. So what did our Supreme Court say about it? Well, our Supreme Court looked at prior case law, and what the Supreme Court said was, we give trial courts a lot of discretion. We really allow those trial court judges to make the decision about whether or not evidence is probative or is it prejudicial. The threshold there on appeal, the burden for the appellant is quite high, right? Absent an abuse of discretion, that's a very high burden to meet because we give so much deference to our trial courts. The district court noted that the posts were prejudicial, okay? Certainly so. They went to his state of mind. However, in balancing the probative value with the prejudice, the probative value outweighed the prejudicial effect. Moreover, the district court specifically mentioned social media is so common, we see it in so many cases every single day. And the fact that these posts were put on the internet so close in time to this alleged incident, certainly there was some relevance there, right? There's certainly some relevance as to his state of mind if he was posting them in very close proximity to the event. So ultimately, our North Dakota Supreme Court affirmed the district court judge's decision to admit the social media posts. Social media related evidence. What types of social media are we seeing in cases today? Facebook still seems, in my practice, and Bailey is my paralegal, she can correct me if I'm wrong, but I would say in my practice in family law, Facebook is most commonly what we're seeing, because Facebook appeals to such a wide generation. There are individuals who are elderly on Facebook, there are young folks on Facebook, it's relatively easy to use. Next would really be Instagram. Instagram is pretty user-friendly. Twitter folks don't really seem to necessarily understand as much. We see it a little bit, but folks tend to be less inclined to discuss their personal life on Twitter for whatever reason. It seems that Twitter is used more for following other people than it is for posting about their own life. Snapchat. Snapchat is unfortunately becoming more and more common, and we are seeing it in cases involving ages 40 and younger primarily, because it is a little bit more complex. The problem with Snapchat, for those who aren't familiar with it, when you send a video, okay, it's called a snap, right? So you're sending this video, it's for a very short duration of time, the other person receives it, they play the video, that video then goes away, or at least it appears that it goes away. When I started at Vogel Law Firm, I was tasked to go through discovery, as Alan pointed out, that many young associates do, and I was going through discovery in a case where a man had lured a minor, was charged with luring a minor using Snapchat, and he figured, that those snaps kind of disappeared, because that's how it appears to an everyday user. Well, I can tell you, when we received the subpoena back from Snapchat, they had all of those videos. They had all of the videos, they had all of the messages, all of the chatting that went back and forth between the two parties. So it's very much discoverable. And all of these forms are very much discoverable. Sometimes it's difficult to get the information directly from the social media domain, the provider. Typically, you can get it through the parties, and we've had some success in doing that. I went to a CLE a couple years ago, and Greg Golden had this, I think, wonderful Miranda-style social media warning to clients. He was a family law attorney as well, and he said in his CLE, you can feel free to share this, so that's what I'm doing with you today. I print this warning off, and I give it to my clients when I first meet with them, when our first consult, and I talk to them about that, because there is this overwhelming tendency, and I'm not sure why, but there is a tendency for individuals when they're going through a divorce or a custody case, it's a very stressful time in their lives, and for some reason their first inclination is to put it out there on the internet, to put it out there on their social media, and typically what they're putting out there is not favorable to their own case, and it certainly does not look good in a court. And so I try and kind of be proactive about that and speak to my clients to say, look, this isn't a good idea. And I know this seems kind of humorous, but I want to talk to you about it because it can make a huge, huge impact in your case. If you are not cognizant, if you don't stop to think about it, and you post it out there, it's searchable, it's discoverable, I can't get it back for you. So you really need to take a second guess before you put it out there. Social media and ethics. I think that social media, while it is wonderful in many ways, it is also disastrous when it comes to litigation. There are certainly ethical implications for us as attorneys, and we certainly have ethical standards that we must adhere to. It is certainly not advisable to create a fake account to interact with an opposing party, opposing counsel, a hostile witness. Now, as attorneys, we inherently, hopefully, know this, and we don't engage in this type of behavior. Unfortunately, clients do it all the time. In a divorce context, one spouse wants to find out if their other spouse is having an affair. And so they create a fake profile, start messaging their spouse, telling them things they want to hear, trying to get their spouse to agree to some sort of an affair, to admit something. And what I tell my clients is, first of all, this is wrong. You should not be doing this at all. But secondly, if that comes before the court's eyes, how is that going to impact your case? Okay, yes, you think it's the smoking gun that your husband or your wife is having an affair. Ultimately, it's really not. Not anymore, at least. And so what is the impact of you creating this fake account? Well, you appear now to be very dishonest. You have lost a lot of credibility with the court, and you're a liar. That can certainly impact your custody case as it relates to children, okay? It can also impact your property and debt distribution under North Dakota law, because we look at the Ruff Fisher factors, one of them being the conduct of the parties during the marriage, meaning what types of parties are these? Are they ethical? Are they good to each other? Do they treat each other well? Are they stabbing each other in the back? What are they doing? So explaining to your client, I think that is extremely, extremely important, that there are other ways that we can find out if that's what you really want to do, whether or not your spouse is engaging in an affair. But you creating a fake account is not the way to do it, because the ramifications are much worse than any benefit you would gain. Social media and third parties. This is a tough one. Posts from third parties are admissible. So typically when we think of a case, we think of two parties, okay? We think of a plaintiff and a defendant, or if we're in Minnesota, a petitioner, a respondent. What about the third parties? Can their posts come into the courtroom? And I have an example for you here, okay? And this is a real example taken from a very recent case. Dad has a domestic violence protection order against him. What does that mean? It means that he committed some act of domestic violence and he can no longer have unsupervised contact with his children for a period of time. Okay? Dad's mother, paternal grandma, asks mom, hey, can I see the kids for a few hours? And mom says, well, you're their grandma, sure. And so grandma picks up the grandchildren and takes them to McDonald's, and she has dad walk into McDonald's, okay? Paternal grandma then posts a photo on Facebook of dad at McDonald's with the two kids. Now, I represented mom in this case, and this protection, mom has this protection order against dad, and so, you know, periodically in my practice, Bailey and I both, between the two of us, we're always looking at people on Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, Twitter, whatever. We're always trying to keep an eye out. And when we saw this photo, we thought, oh my goodness, these kids look like they do right now. You know, they're grown. They look pretty similar to how they look at this point in time. Dad must have violated the domestic violence protection order. So what ultimately happened, my client was able to pull up an old Navy receipt that showed the two shirts that both boys were wearing and when she purchased those two shirts. Okay, she had an online order at Old Navy, so we saw the shirts, we saw the date she ordered them. Well, of course, they were after the protection order went in place, meaning this had to have happened when the protection order was in place. Sent it to the investigator. Investigator's like, that looks like McDonald's. Calls up McDonald's, has a subpoena, goes there, gets the videotape of dad entering McDonald's with grandma. And ultimately now, you know, he resulted in a felony charge, right? A felony charge for violating a protection order for the second time. So if grandma had not posted that photo on Facebook, this never would have happened likely. because my client did not see him at McDonald's. Nobody else knew. It really all stemmed from that third-party post. So when you meet with clients, although we only represent our client that we're engaged with, it is important to talk to our clients about the ramifications of their family members, of their friends posting things on Facebook, because they are still admissible in the court. So what does social media evidence look like in the courtroom? Are they admissible? Generally, they are, so long as they are not obtained illegally. Public posts, in my experience, are always admissible. So advising your clients that they need to have security settings on their social media or just take their, you know, freeze their social media, essentially. With Facebook, it's very common that people are commenting on other photos or commenting on posts. And of course, those statements can come in if they're made by a party and they relate to their case, right? It's a statement against interest to go on Facebook and say, so-and-so, you're such a bad mom, I can't stand you, I can't stand the way you look, etc. Well, mom gets that post, takes a screenshot of it, it's coming into the trial. It's a statement against interest. Authenticity of social media evidence. So the problem with electronic evidence is that it's so easily manipulated by folks who have the sophistication to manipulate it. Now, thankfully, I don't have that knowledge. I guess I don't know what that looks like, but that's also a little bit scary because I may have a client who is very skilled and very deceptive and able to manipulate social media. We know that evidence, in order for it to be admitted, has to be what it is purported to be, right? I mean, that's the general rule. And 901 talks about how do we authenticate evidence. Well, typically, we need to introduce some sort of facts or lay the foundation to clearly establish Exhibit 1 is what we purport Exhibit 1 to be. The most common way that's happening with social media is through testimony of a witness with knowledge. What does that mean in the courtroom? What it means for us as practitioners is that we have all of these third parties who are really kind of tangential to a court case who are now coming in to testify in order to get this social media evidence in. So our trials are naturally going to take longer. We're going to have more folks on the stand. So it really has the ability to draw out these types of cases. Social media and attorneys, as I indicated to you, it is our practice in our firm and my personal practice, before I even meet with a potential client, I am looking up all of their possible social media handles. And sometimes that's been a good way to gauge, this client might be a little crazy, or I just don't want to engage with this client because of what they're posting on Facebook. Do the same thing for the opposing party, and that has certainly led to our benefit in many cases as well. So in terms of our own social media as attorneys, we need to have those privacy settings on there. That's certainly very important. And our clients do naturally as well, because otherwise the opposing party, they're going to be looking for things, right? They're going to be looking for what they can dig up on your client. What is interesting and is how discovery is rapidly changing to keep up with technology. Now, when we serve discovery, we all used to kind of have those blanket questions that we ask, those boilerplate discovery templates. If you do your research, discovery is changing to incorporate much more legal technology. And what I mean by that is, in discovery now, you will see requests for essentially a snapshot of your social media account to be preserved. It's a request to the other side, please preserve all of your social media accounts, all the posts you have, all the photos you have, because what's happening is clients are becoming sophisticated. They're thinking, oh gosh, I have something on my Facebook damaging to me, and they delete their profile. The problem with that, of course, is that then they think it's gone. Well, it's probably still out there some way, somehow. And with Facebook, even when you tell Facebook, I want to delete my profile, it's not deleted immediately. They kind of queue it and they put it in, on the back burner, but it's still discoverable. So Facebook does not get rid of your page or profile in any way, shape, or form. For us as attorneys, we need to be very cognizant, though, in terms of when we serve discovery, to request that the other side provides us with a current snapshot so we can look at their social media in case they do ultimately decide that they are going to try and delete it to hide something, right? Bailey and I, we had a trial about a year ago, and of the exhibits, the overwhelming majority, what you're seeing in trials now, the overwhelming majority is social media related. And the courts are, in my opinion, what I've perceived, becoming sick of it, because what they're reading is thousands of text messages, thousands of Facebook posts, watching videos, looking at Instagram stories, Instagram posts. And so really, when we look at our exhibit list, 9 out of 10 are social media related. Well, if you are able to be proactive in your practice to talk to your clients and to make sure that their family members understand, we need to limit your social media interaction during the course of this litigation, because otherwise the case is going to become about what you posted on social media as opposed to other things that certainly do matter. And it's easy for us as attorneys to kind of focus on the social media, and almost in a way our clients become obsessed with it. So giving that limiting instruction is really what it is to your clients, to say, hey, preserve your profile, but don't do much on there. Okay, really keep it to a minimum, but just keep it intact, is something that we've been doing, and that's how we've been really advising our clients from the get-go. Any questions? Yes.
You mentioned there in that last that pending litigation, mm-hmm. you're always seeing a client sometimes quite a while before before the litigation.
Right.
You see a problem in saying, look, maybe you could delete your Facebook, 6 months before we even sue this thing.
I do see a problem with it, because I think even if there was nothing on there, the other side's going to bring that up in the courtroom, that there's some sort of deceitfulness there, right?
Maybe in a divorce case. I'm talking about non-divorce, non-criminal.
Yep.
Very, generic.
My advice would just be to preserve it as opposed to deleting it. If you're deleting it, inherently there's something wrong with it, so you're getting rid of it, no matter what type of case it is. If you're preserving it, but you're not really active on it, it's there. It's still discoverable, probably regardless. But you take that element away for the other side to be arguing. Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yes, Tammy.
Have you seen social media be helpful to anybody in their cases at all?
I anticipate that attorneys are advising their clients to use social media as a tool to try and help their case. For example, you'll look at an individual and their Facebook has really been dormant for a very long time. They haven't been very active. And then right near proximity as to when their case started, now all of a sudden they're posting a lot. And they're purposefully crafting the content of the post, right? So I certainly see that. I see people trying to then admit that at trial. Look at all these photos that I post, and me with my kids or me doing whatever. In terms of it being a benefit, it was certainly a benefit to us in the McDonald's case, right? So a benefit to us, not to the other attorney at all. I mean, and that's what's difficult, is if you are that other attorney, well, now the damage is done. It's on Facebook, and the person's been identified in the photo, tagged in the photo. You have a serious problem there. Right. Any other questions? Sarah?
Some parents are remarkably naive about social media. Mother posts stuff on Snapchat. And they took to her Google photography log. She gives her son on his smartphone, lets him use her Google account to access the internet. He goes to his dad's house and they monitor the cell phone very carefully. Stepmother looks at the phone and is able to download everything from the mother's Google, what do you call it?
Account.
Drive, mm-hmm. Including all those photos that have been, she thought were private, very damaging videos, text messages between her husband when they were contemplating divorce. All of this is on the kid's phone. The kid doesn't see it, but the stepmother and father have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there was actually a recent case in Grand Forks District Court where mom alleged kind of a similar scenario, Sarah, where mom gave her old cell phone to her son, and the allegation was that dad, while the son was sleeping, dad took some son's thumb and used it to get, you know, the fingerprint, get on the cell phone, backed it up to the last cloud, most recent, you know, restoring it to the last backup, and then was able to get everything of mom. Similar case. So there was a motion in limine to exclude it because it was illegally obtained. District court judge still let it all in anyway.
Well, in this case, there was no motion. And no I motion. Don't represent the party on the custody. Emergency motion to change custody, and every single exhibit was filed with the court, out there for everyone to see until they were sealed.
Scary stuff.
Yeah, it's embarrassing.
You know, on a similar note, if somebody breaks into somebody else's social media account, I imagine that probably happens all the time, especially in the scenario you described. Somebody thinks somebody's cheating on them, they get on there. Would that be excluded?
We've tried to exclude it before, and it's still been admissible.
It's like letting in. If somebody out there can find it, they're letting it in. That's really interesting. So it's like, because you can kind of see the intention to make something public, that feels very different than the intention to keep something
mm-hmm.
private, almost like a search and seizure issue or something there.
Part of it, I think, is what the North Dakota Supreme Court tells our district court, which is we'd rather hear all of the evidence than not enough. What I tend to see is district courts, and Sarah and Cassie can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, I tend to see they're letting everything in, and then the response the judge gives when you object is, I will give the piece of evidence the weight and credibility it deserves, but they're still admitting it into evidence. Hannah, you had a question?
That was a real case.
I was just wondering if you see juries putting more weight on social media posts versus judges, especially with how prevalent social media is, maybe the bench has a different experience with social media than
Well, with the case that we talked about, I think what's interesting from reading even the, you know, at the district court level, the problem is when, and as we all know, when you give a jury a limiting instruction, what does that really mean? I mean, we've done our job, we've limited them, but how are they going to weigh that evidence is very difficult to control. I agree with you. I think that juries certainly put a lot of weight and put a lot of eggs into that basket because it's such direct evidence with a lot of relevance. But then again, as do district court judges. Because we had one district court judge here in Grand Forks who said, well, you know, family law cases in particular, and in many cases are very he said, she said, but posts and social media is black and white. I can see what was posted. There's no question about it. So that's why they're admitting it. They want to see it. Yeah. Well, thank you very much.